If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Tuesday, July the 10th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, a Hoover Research Fellow. Our guest today in Hoover's recording studio, deep in the heart of Stanford University's campus in the shadow of the Hoover Tower, is Adam White. Adam is a Hoover Institution Research Fellow based out of our Washington, D.C. office. He's director of the Center for the Study of Administrative State at George Mason University's Antonin Scalia Law School, where he also teaches administrative law. He writes widely on the administrative state, the Constitution, and the Supreme Court, which means you have been one busy man for not just the last 24 hours, but really about the last 12 days since Justice Kennedy announced his retirement. It's been 21 hours since the announcement was made, Adam. Have you had any sleep?
It's been a couple of good days, that's for sure. I have to say, obviously there were a lot of good names on President Trump's list and among the final four. Judge Kavanaugh, when he was selected, nobody can say that Trump and the White House didn't try to pick the best candidate. Mm-hmm. He's really the ideal candidate, I think, for this moment in time. Barrett would have been good. Others would have been great, too. But nobody, I think, can really fault the White House for this pick.
Okay, I wrote a column in which I marveled at the fact that they rolled this out for 12 days, and they did. Maybe this is just because Trump is a creature of reality TV, and he knows how to build cliffhangers and suspense. And my God, the announcement did have a lot of look and feel of reality TV in terms of having the guy walk out and, what, accept the robe and not the rose, as the joke goes, and all that. But he stayed on message. He stuck to his list. There weren't any screw-ups, and in the end, you got what appears to be a good justice. Were you surprised by the pick?
No, I wasn't.
So in 2020 hindsight, if you had to handicap the four, which did you expect?
Of the last four, I wasn't going to be surprised by any of them. Mm-hmm. Now, the conversations tended to be Kavanaugh and this person and right. Kavanaugh and that person. So sometimes you look at it and say, well, Kavanaugh is always in the running. Or you might always look at it and say, well, they're always looking for somebody other than Kavanaugh.
Right.
But these four, all of them struck me as pretty plausible. All four of them. Kethledge was a lesser known quantity, but all four of them, Hardiman, Kethledge, Barrett, and Kavanaugh, were respectable candidates.
So take me through your last 21 hours. The announcements, you know, we're sitting here in California. You've been on the West Coast for the past few days. So the announcement is made at 6:01 local time, and then what do you do?
I sat down to dinner with some friends in San Francisco. I spent the entire day yesterday sort of contributing to the media cacophony surrounding the pick. We did a few TV shows and a few radio interviews, just going. At that point, by Monday morning, it was Hardiman and Kavanaugh, so talking mostly about them. As it happens, I had dinner plans to meet with some Silicon Valley folks about an article on a totally different subject, a piece I wrote called Google.gov about Google and the administrative state.
Yes.
So I heard the nomination as I was walking into dinner, and then I came out afterwards and began processing it. But the thing is, with Kavanaugh, I mean, you said earlier I run a thing called the Center for the Study of the Administrative State.
Right.
To study the administrative state for the last 10 years means in no small part to study Kavanaugh's opinions.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The series of opinions he's written on the D.C. Circuit on things ranging from judicial deference to the agencies or agency structure or the powers given by Congress to the agencies. Kavanaugh has written a really remarkable, thoughtful series of opinions and law review articles too. Mm-hmm. And so Kavanaugh's record is very familiar to me. It's been easy to talk about him for the last few days. And I think it's fitting that Kavanaugh may now reach the Supreme Court himself because his ideas have really preceded him to the court. Even when his arguments haven't prevailed in the D.C. Circuit, oftentimes his reasoning has been adopted by the Supreme Court. A couple of years ago I said, you know, there's the old Bible line, a prophet has no honor in his own hometown. Sometimes that felt like Kavanaugh. Even when he wasn't carrying the day in the D.C. Circuit, he was getting a lot more respect elsewhere. He was sort of a Jeremiah of the administrative state.
Right. Interesting contrast, I thought, Adam, was Lena Kagan. He mentioned her in his remarks at the White House because she taught him at Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
Kagan is put on the bench and by Obama, and she has two things going for her as a justice. Number one, not much of a paper trail. Not been a judge. And number two, she's 50 years old. So were you surprised that the age doesn't surprise us because 50 is the new 60 in the Supreme Court now, I guess. You want judges who will serve for 30 years. Were you surprised, though, that he did go at somebody with as much of a track record? I know we've heard the pushback that, well, okay, this is going to gum up the works of the proceedings, that you're going to have to, you know, spend a lot of time vetting the nominee and his record. But were you surprised still that Trump didn't go with a pass of little less resistance, which would have been, I guess, would have been Hardiman?
No, as you know, it cuts both ways, right? The paper trail is bureaucratically a challenge for a confirmation hearing. You have his decade plus on the federal bench, mm-hmm. and before that his time in the Bush administration, and before that his time on the Ken Starr team.
Right.
So you have all of these government records that we marshaled, searched, reviewed. At the same time, though, in getting back to something you said earlier, President Trump's nominations have in his two Supreme Court nominations and his nominations to the lower court, he's really kept his covenant with the conservative movement mm-hmm. that he would be good on judges.
Right.
And in picking somebody like Kavanaugh, who does have a long paper trail, I think he was keeping faith with that original promise to be solid on judges.
Right.
And so with other judges, like I said, Kethledge, Barrett, Hardiman, they'd been on the bench for varying degrees of time. They had varying paper trails in on the bench and in academia. Kavanaugh's paper trail exceeds all of them, but by that same token, conservatives could be most comfortable with a Kavanaugh pick.
Mm-hmm. Two picks now for Donald Trump, Neil Gorsuch and now Brett Kavanaugh.
Mm-hmm.
Conservatives, the reaction by conservatives is interesting. There are a lot of conservatives who are pleased with this pick. There are, of course, some conservatives for whom Kavanaugh is not sufficiently conservative. Reminds me of the Trump theme song at the end of his rallies, "You can't always get what you want, you get what you need." Is there a legitimate criticism of this pick, though?
Well, some of the criticism from the right has been phrased, and I'd say the Rand Paul argument, that Kavanaugh, a product
Rand Paul, this is a Fourth Amendment argument that Rand Paul makes, right?
Exactly. That Kavanaugh's record in the Bush administration and then on the bench is one that's too deferential to executive assertions of power mm-hmm. in national security, you know, burdening on civil liberties,
mm-hmm.
right? So there's that argument or that criticism of Kavanaugh.
Right.
Another criticism of Kavanaugh is sort of, I don't know how the best way to phrase it is it's bad to pick Kavanaugh because he could have picked a more sort of clearly defined culture war nominee.
Amy Coney Barrett.
This is the judge on the Seventh Circuit. She's only been on the Seventh Circuit a short time. Trump put her there. And after he nominated her, she received withering attack in the Senate from Feinstein,
right.
Durbin, for her religious beliefs.
Right.
And that really, I think, first of all, people were impressed by how she carried herself in the nomination.
Mm-hmm.
She was really brave. And she held her ground. And at the same time, people saw her, I think rightly, as a symbol of this new religious test for office that you see arising
right.
around judicial nominations. So some people would say by not picking her, Trump gave short shrift to the religious liberty conservatives, and I'm among religious liberty conservatives.
Right.
But again, I think that it's hard really to criticize Kavanaugh for these things, especially when you see how solid he is on other issues.
And that also leads Adam to the reality that this is a two-part process, that the president has to make a pick, but then secondly, that pick has to get confirmed by the Senate, and Donald Trump is dealing with 50 Republican seats in the Senate right now. 51, mm-hmm. but John McCain is not going to be with us to vote, so 50. So he has precious room to navigate, and so Amy Coney Barrett, in some respects, becomes a luxury in this process. But we were talking about this before we went on the air. The Democratic reaction to Kavanaugh, which I think we would call over the top,
yeah.
a little overheated. You're in San Francisco. You're at Ground Central of it. Why are they going so crazy over Kavanaugh when the fact of the matter is if the Senate comes back more Republican the next time and if, God forbid, something happens to Ruth Bader Ginsburg or Justice Breyer, Ginsburg is 85 years old, Breyer turns 80 next month, their time is limited on the court. If Donald Trump gets another pick, Adam, now you're talking about changing the balance because you're now replacing a Democratic pick with a Republican pick, completely different from Kavanaugh. Why, Adam, are the Democrats going so crazy over this pick?
Well, and the craziness started before Kavanaugh was named, right? The ink was barely dry on Kennedy's retirement letter.
Yeah.
When you saw outlandish calls from the left saying the next Democratic president should stack the court.
Right.
They should find a way to block this nomination. It was really something. And now you're even seeing conspiracy theories about Kennedy. First, it was Kennedy retired because of his son's bank lending money to Trump, which makes literally no sense as a conspiracy theory. But now there's a new conspiracy theory that Kennedy and Trump had a handshake deal, that
so
Kavanaugh.
Step down if it's Kavanaugh. Right.
Yeah, and Kavanaugh is a Kennedy clerk. And well, I wouldn't be surprised if Kennedy expressed, you know, views on who he hoped would see fill his seat. But the idea that there's some sort of deal is just ridiculous. You already saw criticism of Kennedy on his way out the door after almost 25 years of being a lion on the court for issues of abortion and same-sex marriage and so on.
Right. But actually, you know, this actually goes back to Gorsuch in this regard. Here's Neil Gorsuch, who is about as close to unimpeachable as I think we get on this planet. And he gets 45 no votes, Adam.
Yeah.
That's the highest no votes for a successful nominee since Clarence Thomas, who passed on a 52-48 vote. Gorsuch was 54-45, yeah. I think. 45 Democrats voted against this guy. Now, it's easy to say, okay, they still had the taste of Merrick Garland in their mouth. They were still upset about that. But still, 45 Democrats went along with that, and obviously there'll be at least 45 votes against this nominee. What is the Democratic mindset here? And you've been puzzled by this because it seems like the Democrats are always fighting the wrong fight on this.
And it's funny, you said that Gorsuch is unimpeachable. That's a dangerous word to throw around Democrats right now.
That is true.
But
no, but he's a high-character guy, and so you know, you can't vote for him because you don't think he's qualified, and you can't vote for him because you think he's a hideous human being. There has to be an X factor, which is obviously Donald Trump. But again, why are you taking out on Gorsuch, and why are you taking it out on Kavanaugh, when the fact of the matter is Kavanaugh replaces the Republican pick?
Well, and let's start with Gorsuch really quickly. You're right. In the immediate aftermath of President Trump's inauguration, the Democrats declared total war on Gorsuch, even though Gorsuch filling the Scalia seat was basically a status quo appointment. It was replacing one conservative originalist with another.
Right.
The Kennedy seat is slightly different. Kennedy has been a strong conservative on a lot of structural constitutional issues. Mm-hmm. Actually, I think he deserves more credit than he gets from conservatives. Conservatives, to the extent that they're frustrated with him, it's over his vote in liberty cases like abortion, same-sex marriage, and so on. Those are the cases where Kennedy really alienated a lot of conservatives.
Right.
So that replacement does have – so replacing Kennedy will have a bit of an ideological shift. I think it's significant, actually. I'm not saying that Roe v. Wade is going away tomorrow or Obergefell, the same-sex marriage case, is going away tomorrow. They're not. Mm-hmm. But if nothing else – for decades now, the progressive left has known that they had safety in the court for these hot-button issues. In a piece I wrote for the Weekly Standard, I said this was Justice Kennedy's Camelot. This was the safe place where the left could protect these rights, abortion, the gay right issues, same-sex marriage, could protect them from the political forces outside the walls. They thought that they were going to just continue a steady expansion of those rights over time. Even if those rights aren't pulled back, the expansion is probably stopped at this point for now.
Right.
And I think the left lost its mind just over the end of that expansion of rights. And I'm sure some of them in good faith, a lot of them in good faith, are worried about Roe v. Wade, Roe Obergefell. I think those are misplaced. I think they're unreasonable arguments. But just the loss of this future where the arc of history continued to bend towards their vision of justice has really upset them. And so you saw upon Kavanaugh's nomination, you saw on TV these protests on the steps of the Supreme Court. And I think it was Senator Liz Warren, Senator Cory Booker, Bernie Sanders, and others. I might be getting them wrong. I just saw some of the footage. You know, these people offering fiery speeches on the steps of the Supreme Court.
Right.
It's funny. They're very confident in rallying political forces, but they're doing it because they think they need the protection of the counter-political force of the Supreme Court. It's a politics to keep some issues out of politics.
I would explain those senators. Leslie Adam, Bill Clinton wrote a letter to a fellow named Eugene Holmes when he was in college. Bill Clinton, was about to get drafted, and he wanted to get out of the draft, and so he went to Colonel Holmes, who was at the ROTC at Arkansas, University of Arkansas, and asked for Holmes to get him a deferment, which Holmes did, and then Clinton backed out of the deferment once he got a high draft lottery. Clinton, then being Bill Clinton, had to rationalize why he did this, so he wrote a very long letter to Colonel Holmes, and in it is this phrase. He said he had to apply for ROTC to, quote, maintain my viability in the system. I would argue, Adam, that the likes of Cory Booker, Elizabeth Warren, Kirsten Gillibrand, any Democrat who is going crazy on the steps of the Supreme Court, we're talking crazy over heated manners right now, they're trying to maintain their viability in the realm of the 2020 election.
Yeah, that's simple. That is, I think, very true. That's very true.
Let me run four topics by you, Adam, and let's talk about how you think the Democrats will approach and how you think Kavanaugh will joust.
Sure.
They are, in no particular order, Roe v. Wade, healthcare, which Chuck Schumer talked about today, presidential authority and protection, the balance of power, which gets back to the conspiracy theories that he's going to cut Donald Trump a break, and then finally Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
Because he will be the sixth Catholic judge on the court. Mm-hmm. I don't think Catholicism comes up that much in the confirmation hearing. I think Dianne Feinstein kind of ran into a buzzsaw, and she brought this up with Amy Coney Barrett. But Roe, health care, and presidential power, Adam, let's talk about those. What do you think the Democrat approaches will be?
Okay. Right at the outset, I think it's important to keep one thing in mind. Mm-hmm. Judge Kavanaugh is not just a nominee. He is also a sitting judge.
Right.
Right. And so in that respect, he is limited by the Code of Judicial Ethics from prejudging issues. Even if you could say that, you know, an ordinary nominee, say Elena Kagan when she was a non-judge nominated to the Supreme Court, you know, pressing her for answers is one thing, or any other non-judge up for nomination. But a sitting judge does have to be reticent on some issues.
Right.
So when it comes to Roe v. Wade, I suspect that Kavanaugh will justifiably do what nominees always do now, mm-hmm. which is avoid any sort of answer on what they would do if the issue were relitigated before them.
I've heard you talk about this on other podcasts, like on the Ricochet podcast you got into this, and that's the idea of the thought that Roe v. Wade is going to be tossed out of court tomorrow. You're of the school of thought that no.
Yeah.
That you just don't see a direct challenge to it. So you're suggesting that maybe you're of the school of thought that it's, to the extent abortion is going to be dealt with, it's going to be kind of nickel and dime restrictions here and there. Are smaller cases that come before the court, but they can sort of handle on a piecemeal basis.
Right. There's no shortage of litigation around the margins
right.
of the abortion right. Every time a state tries to impose new regulations or restrictions on abortion, it gets litigated. Let me just walk through really quickly the road it would take to get to a Supreme Court relitigation of the Roe v. Wade issue. First, you would need a state legislature and executive
right.
to pass a law that doesn't just sort of work around the edges, but actually goes at the heart of the right to abortion, mm-hmm. right? A complete bar or an effective bar on abortion in its earliest stages.
Right.
Right. I mean, Congress might do that too, but Congress doesn't pass laws anymore, so
right.
we'll set that aside. So it would take a state legislature and executive to do that. The next step is the challenge. The challengers, say the ACLU, Planned Parenthood, whoever, they have to decide where to file their lawsuit and under what law. Now with the shift in the court, you'll see the challengers prefer to go to state court under the state constitution. We saw this in my home state of Iowa. Mm-hmm. Iowa passed some new laws regulating aspects of abortion. ACLU and Planned Parenthood didn't sue under the U.S. Constitution in U.S. court. They filed suit in the Iowa courts invoking the Iowa Constitution. Because if you can get your state Supreme Court to declare the issue unlawful under the state constitution, there's no U.S. Supreme Court appeal. Those issues don't go to the Supreme Court. So only when the challengers decide that a law directly targeting Roe v. Wade doesn't have a good prospect for success in the state's own courts under the state's own constitution, then they will file their case in federal court.
Right.
And then you'll have two layers of review where the issue is going to be framed and reframed. Always will be a question, is this law really a challenge to Roe itself, or is this some sort of tangential challenge mm-hmm. to regulating abortion? Only then will it get to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the court will grapple with both the merits. Oh,
yeah.
Sorry.
That's if four justices want to take it on.
Right.
And I think one thing to consider here, you tell me if I'm correct, we're in an age now where we call Supreme Courts, we title them by the name of the chief. There's mm-hmm. a Warren Court, there's a Burger Court, there's now a Roberts Court. Justice Roberts showed on Obamacare that perhaps legacy is part of his thinking, and maybe he didn't want to be the guy who torpedoed Obamacare.
Right.
So he upholds his constitutionality. Adam, do you think if Kavanaugh is confirmed, will there be four justices who would actually want to take up a Roe challenge?
I just don't know because I don't know where Kavanaugh is on this.
Right.
It's just too hard to say.
Right.
But your focus on Roberts, I think, is important.
Mm-hmm.
Roberts, like every Chief Justice, has more of an institutional mind than the other justices.
Right.
We saw some of this, as you said, in the Obamacare cases. As a great example, Rehnquist, when he was just a regular justice in the 70s, he was much more conservative and forward-leaning than after he transitioned to Chief Justice
mm-hmm.
and became much more institutional, more restrained. Roberts will be the key vote in this, both with respect to whether the court takes the case of a challenge to Roe v. Wade,
mm-hmm.
and also in terms of what we call stare decisis, right? This is that sort of metaphysical question about, about how much weight to give a precedent, right, even when the precedent itself is dubious on the merits. When do you keep a precedent, even when you have doubts about it, for the sake of legal stability? And that is another place where Roberts, I think, will be very, very important.
You mentioned Rehnquist. He's interesting, Adam, in this regard. He, once upon a time, was the high watermark for disapproval for a successful nominee.
Right.
When he is confirmed as chief, he has all of 33 no votes.
Right.
So if you think of the Mendoza line in baseball, that was kind of it for the court, 33 no votes. Then along comes Thomas, and it gets raised to 48. If you look at the last three picks on the court, Kagan got 37 no votes, Adam. Alito got 42. Gorsuch got 45. Sotomayor actually got less than 33. But we're in this new age now where there's a high number of negative votes. Is this it now for Supreme Court battle? I was looking at videotape of Scalia the other day in his confirmation hearing. And my God, what a time warp to a different Washington, Adam.
Yeah.
There he is being interviewed by Hal Heflin, back at a time when there were actually Democratic senators from the South.
Yeah.
So there's old Hal Heflin talking to him. There is Scalia sitting there holding a pipe.
Yes.
God forbid you wave a tobacco product in, right, in public these days. And Scalia is approved unanimously by the Senate.
Right.
A man who, if anybody was a conservative Catholic, I mean, that is the picture of the dictionary, Antonin Scalia.
Mm-hmm.
But now we're talking about, with a guy like Neil Gorsuch getting 45, Kavanaugh guaranteed to get 45 plus 47, who knows what the final figure is. Is this a new reality of the court, and is there any way to put the genie back in the bottle?
Well, there's a few points on this, and we're going to get back to Scalia because he's very important on this. First of all, you identified the political issue, right? You said there used to be Democratic senators in the South. I mean, part of this is a question about political polarization.
Yeah, Thomas, for example, had 11 Democrats support,
yes,
him at the end of the day.
Right. So, you know, maybe the best person to ask these questions to is Mo Fiorina, right, on political polarization. So that's part of it. Second is greater public awareness, I think, of that's not right. The court's always, public's always been aware of the court. But the court's become a more salient political issue at the grassroots level, especially in the aftermath of Roe v. Wade, and especially after 92, when the Supreme Court reaffirmed Roe v. Wade, more or less, in the Planned Parenthood v. Casey case. That was
right. The
one that really galvanized conservatives, especially, to take this seriously. Now, how do we get out of this? Well, I think it's important to keep in mind Justice Scalia's dissent in the Planned Parenthood case in 92. There's a coda at the end, a really remarkable passage, where Scalia says, you know, more and more people worry about the political heat surrounding confirmation hearings.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is, Supreme Court confirmation hearings will be highly politicized as long as the court itself is highly politicized. He said, there's a great line he said, so if the people think that the court is just in the business of making value judgments for a country, well, the people themselves are perfectly capable of making value judgments too, and they'll want their values incorporated by the court, and they'll make these things known in the confirmation process. And so I think as long as the court is involved in deciding at the national level these hotly contested legal issues, and I don't just mean abortion, same-sex marriage, affirmative action, and so on, a whole panoply of issues. As long as the court is decisive on these hotly contested national value judgments, the confirmation hearing is always going to look like this, as long as there is at least some sort of critical mass of both parties in Congress.
Sandra Day O'Connor, unanimous consent.
Mm-hmm.
Anthony Kennedy, unanimous consent. Adam White, let me ask you this question. If you were Senator Adam White,
yeah,
Senator from what state would you want? Iowa, Virginia? Where would you want to represent?
I'd take either Iowa or Virginia.
How about one of the new states in California? We may have a couple new states for
you. Oh, good.
You're Senator White, and you're sitting on the Judiciary Committee.
Yeah.
What questions do you want to ask Judge Kavanaugh?
Well, let's assume that I arrived at the Senate after my time studying the administrative state and so on. I already know where Kavanaugh stands on a lot of these administrative state issues.
Right.
So I probably wouldn't need to ask that question. I think if I were to ask him one question, it would be, what role does tradition play in constitutional interpretation? Right? When the court is thinking about these constitutional terms like liberty, which appears in the Fifth Amendment, 14th Amendment, it's not an easily defined term. One of the ways to think about liberty is in the context of liberty arising through the lived experience of the United States. There are Supreme Court cases, a famous one called Washington versus Glucksberg, where they say, when we vindicate individual liberty through the 14th Amendment, we're going to do it with an we ought to do it with an eye to tradition and basic principles of ordered liberty, and limit the judicial creation or expansion of rights to things that fit within that tradition. As a skeptic of say judicial micromanagement of the government from both the left and the right. Right? I don't want the country being governed by a court of liberal justices, just as I wouldn't want it governed just by a court of libertarian justices, although I quite like libertarians. I would rather the people have the lead hand in governing themselves. My question for Kavanaugh would be, as you think about liberty, how does tradition fit into this? And how can or should tradition be a relevant consideration in trying to define a judicial vision of liberty?
Let me ask you a question from a California standpoint. I live in a state, Adam, which is just slap happy in its approach to litigation. When there is a conflict with the federal government since Donald Trump took office, Adam, the governor, the lieutenant general, a concerned party, decides to file a lawsuit in federal court to block the policy, ultimately to force the Supreme Court to act. Is this what the Supreme Court was designed to do?
It's like the old people's court thing, right? Have you been injured in a Trump administration? Don't take the law into your own hands. Take them to court. There's been a lot of that. It's interesting. This is one of those things that cycles politically.
Right? I know Texas did this to Obama.
Right. Before I joined the Hoover Institution, I was a practicing lawyer. I was in litigation alongside states, sometimes represented states in some of these cases.
Right.
But that wasn't the beginning of it either, right? The Republicans maybe were better organized in challenging the Obama administration, but one of the most famous cases from the Bush years was Massachusetts versus EPA, right? States pushing the EPA to regulate greenhouse gas emissions.
Right.
And before that, and that was just an expansion of people like my home state Attorney General Tom Miller in Iowa, Elliot Spitzer, these attorney generals who really turbocharged the office. Mm-hmm. So this has been a long evolution. Both sides get credit and blame for it. But the question is this any way to run a country? No. It is good that we're finding an aspect of federalism. This is one way to re-interject real federalism or federalism concerns into these cases. When states get involved in regulatory proceedings and then sue federal agencies, they're often raising federalism issues, and that's a good thing because
right.
The Senate isn't quite the same thing it used to be in terms of being a representation of federalism. But I'd say on the whole, almost every case that's brought, there's always a reason for it. Right. I'm not saying I agree with every case, but any one case is easy to justify. But a government by litigation is just no way to run a country.
You know, I don't see Senator White teaming up a lot with Senator Blumenthal.
Right.
Richard Blumenthal, the senator of Connecticut, who was, of course, an attorney general beforehand, who is yet another voice out in front saying whoever the president picks doesn't matter. He or she will be awful.
I when I was in private practice on energy law, Blumenthal was an attorney general trying to block energy projects
right.
Up in New England. And so he knows very well the power of courts. He also knows very well the power of litigation. But it's interesting, to answer your point, it's interesting to see people coming out and preemptively disavowing whoever the nominee was. I saw one group put out a press release. They accidentally said, we oppose
blank.
XX for the Supreme Court. And I think that was the perfect embodiment or the perfect encapsulation of our present political moment.
You know, Adam, computers, whoever the device is on, they have to do a better job of hiding the send button.
Right.
It must be like launching a missile. You must have to like turn two keys at the same time or
right.
go through four steps. Too many people accidentally do that. But yeah, to put out blank.
Right. And be sure to clear all your track changes too.
Speaking of which, what happened to Elliot Spitzer? Where is he these days?
I got to admit, I didn't expect that question.
Play Jeopardy for, you know, aspiring aggressive attorney generals for 400 hours.
I don't think he's in jail. I would say he is probably roaming the streets of Manhattan. I hope he's very happy. I think it's probably very good that he no longer wields government power of any kind.
Okay. I now want to take up issue with your pedigree, Adam White, and don't take this personally, but you are a Harvard man.
I'm an Iowa Hawkeye
I'm
man
Iowa
first,
Hawkeye,
but then, look, and then I'm a Harvard man.
There's a dark secret in your resume. You went to Harvard Law.
I did.
What year?
I'm marked my age. I was just 2004, thereby undermining any credibility I have to being a serious legal scholar. I graduated from Harvard Law School in 2004.
Did Elizabeth Warren teach you?
No. She was one of the most well-regarded professors on campus. Mm-hmm. Actually, if I had been interested in bankruptcy law, I would have taken her class. I tried to sign up for Elena Kagan's class, but she became dean and canceled it. But it was a busy campus.
Okay, Brett Kavanaugh is not a Harvard man. He is a Yale man, and I mean he is seriously bulla bulla. 4 years undergrad, 3 years law, seven
right.
years. So he is a double dipper.
Right.
I think there are four or five justices, Adam, who are double dippers as well on this court.
Hmm.
Did both their undergrad and their grad. Every justice on the court right now, Adam, if Kavanaugh is confirmed, all nine will have either a Harvard or Yale law pedigree.
Yes.
Good thing or bad thing?
Well, I think I've already made clear I'm a big fan of the Kavanaugh nomination. I'd say, in general, all else being equal, some more diversity in terms of background, intellectual, and, and educational pedigree would be a good thing.
The point here is not to bash the Ivy League, but the point would be this, that Donald Trump is working off a list of judges. And the Federalist Society, whoever drew up the list, made it a point to include a lot of judges from outside the Beltway, outside the D.C. Circuit, and a lot of judges who went to law schools like Notre Dame, which is, I think, where Amy Coney Barrett went. Michigan, one of the judges went
Kethledge to Michigan. Kethledge was Michigan, Hardiman was Georgetown.
Georgetown, right. So good law schools, but not Harvard and Yale necessarily. So the point and the expectation by some with Donald Trump was he was going to pick more, dare we say, populist judges. Yeah. And yet now he has had two picks, and he's gone Harvard, Yale, right?
Yeah.
So is this at all something to be concerned about?
Well, I'd say systematically it would be good to get more diversity. I mean, it's not too long ago there were two Supreme Court justices from Stanford on the court, which obviously is a good thing, Rehnquist and O'Connor. I think getting more diversity in that respect, though, would help. One other thing, I want to get back to education, but just in terms of their legal background, right? Kavanaugh has worked in government and in private practice in Washington, D.C.
Right.
One of the things, nice things to be said for the nominees that didn't make the cut in the last round, right, is they had varying backgrounds. They worked in private practice. Kethledge worked at Ford for a while. That's a good thing. I think the only judge on the court right now with any kind of in-house counsel experience is Justice Thomas, who worked for a short time at Monsanto. I'd say more diversity in that respect is a good thing. Watching Trump go through the list itself, as you said, was very diverse, and it sent a lot of signals to different political constituencies. But when he actually went about picking judges, and he picked at the Supreme Court Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, again, two judges I both admire immensely, and I admired them before they were even nominated. It sometimes felt as President Trump went around picking judges that he was hiring judges the way that he would hire a lawyer. Right, he looked at their resume. He liked the Harvard logo, the Harvard or Yale pedigrees on the resumes, and he picked the sort of he picked Supreme Court justices in the same way that you might pick a lawyer to represent you in private practice, you know, on reputation. Now, of course, in this case with Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, it didn't lead him astray. But I would say, in general, more diversity of background, both in their education and their practice experience, would be a good thing on the court.
Right. So, you know, you hear a lot of stuff secondhand through this process. You hear that Coney Barrett was a very interesting pick for Trump. Why? There was a huge political consideration to it, that she is the nominee. She's put up before the Senate. Invariably, somebody's going to overplay their hand. They're going to beat up a woman who is the mother to seven children. I think two were adopted. There's a special need child. This is a very compelling person, so she's not Cruella de Vil. So probably very good politics to have her up there, good optics, maybe also mobilize a Catholic vote. So political consideration. Plus, as you mentioned, the people who want to fight in his base, this is their person. You heard people talk about Hardiman, and that Hardiman drove a cab, I think, when he was going through college. Hardiman knew Trump's sister, who was a judge. They had a past a collegial relationship. Maybe Trump bonded with them. You don't know Donald Trump personally, I assume, and I think we all spend way too much time trying to get in Donald Trump's head. But you look at the selection process, Adam, and is that what you take away, that Trump looked at this like he would hiring a lawyer and thought that this is the smartest guy and this is the guy who would win my case?
Well, the White House obviously took the process very seriously, and I don't want to sell them short on that, right? Both this time and last time, the original list, the shorter list, and the final couple, they were always solid, it seemed to me, solid candidates.
Yeah, that's an important thing to underscore. Let's give the White House some credit where credit is deserved. They do a lot of things wrong. And almost on a daily basis, there is some crisis going on. Some dumpster fire has started. A lot of that starts with the president, who cannot stay disciplined and stay on message. He has to tweet. He has to cause brouhahas. But he stayed on message throughout this. He said, I have a list, and I'm working off the list. We didn't see him stray. We didn't see Judge Judy or Judge Jeanine pop in the conversation. Nothing crazy happened in this. He stayed on course. They started with 20. They got down to 4, teased a little bit here and there, added a couple, subtracted a couple. But from start to finish, they drove this very smartly for 12 days.
Well, to be fair, you might be saving Judge Judy and Judge Perot and his sister Judge Trump for the Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
By the way, Judge Walker's still alive.
Right,
97 years old. He's still out there.
But I think you seized upon a really key point, which is that for all of the chaos and discord in any administration, but of course in this administration, right now, the question of judicial politics and the politics of appointing judges is the one place where everybody's unified. And I think it was Ross Douthat at the New York Times, maybe somebody else, who pointed out that this really isn't a coincidence. For all the fractures within the Republican and conservative coalitions, the courts, the judges, the kind of judge, is the one place where we have the most unity within the coalition and perhaps the best organized advocates, right? Whether it's the Heritage Foundation or the Federalist Society, all these groups, the Institute for Justice. This is one place where the whole coalition is rowing in the same direction. Mm-hmm. And I think the proof is in the pudding.
Okay, Adam, final question for you. This is the question of deliberation and hearings. Mm-hmm. We've talked about the high number of negatives. Here's another bad trend. Sandra Day O'Connor, 12 hours of questions. Kennedy, 11 hours. Thurgood Marshall, a hugely historic figure, first African-American on the court, 7 hours of question. Adams, Gorsuch, Roberts, Breyer, Ginsburg, Thomas, Souter all received at least 20-plus hours of questions. Mm-hmm. Bork received 30. Yeah. What's your over-under, 20 or 30?
Well, first, I want to reject the premise. I think you're being generous in saying it was 20 hours of questions. What it really is about 19 hours of speeches
and
an hour of questions.
Right. But these would just become big, drawn-out, let's play for the camera, pontificate, be theatrical, emote proceedings.
I think it's inevitable that this one will go particularly long, not just because of the political environment and not just because it's Kennedy being replaced and we have heightened awareness of this nomination. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, as we said, Brett Kavanaugh has a long background.
Right.
And I think it'll be hard for the Senate, the Senate Judiciary Committee, to truncate this hearing when there is just a lot of material to work with. But I do want to say about the hearings, since we spend a lot of time talking about how awful they are, mm-hmm. how venomous they can be,
right.
I do want to say that it's sort of the worst of times and the best of times. Obviously, the confirmation hearings are bad in so many respects, and I think this one may be the worst, maybe someday even worse, remembered to be as being worse than Thomas and Bork. I think it could be that poisonous. That said, these confirmation hearings are also in some ways government at its best, where you're going to see senators and the nominee and the whole public around debating precedents, debating what it means to be a precedent, debating what it means to have a constitution and a rule of law, but also a government of the people that has an actual democratic politics. These sorts of debates, they are American constitutionalism at its best. Mm-hmm. And so while it'll be easy and I think to get dismayed, and I think people will rightly be dismayed at moments in this process, I think we should all also celebrate the fact that every few years we have a Supreme Court nomination that centers the entire country's debates around what it means to have a constitution and a rule of law. And that's a luxury that in so many other countries the people just don't enjoy.
That's well put. Here's what fascinates me in regard to Brett Kavanaugh, Adam. There's a high road and a low road to take. And the high road is an honest discussion about reproductive rights and health care and your view of the Constitution and talk about what a judge does. The low road is if you go back to the last 20 years of American politics, there is Brett Kavanaugh. Mm-hmm. I've heard him called Zelig and Forrest Gump in this regard. The Clinton impeachment. He co-wrote the Starr Report, which laid the groundwork for Bill Clinton's impeachment. Mm-hmm. He was the pro bono counsel for Elian Gonzalez during the deportation controversy in Florida. Yeah. He was involved in Bush v. Gore in the Florida recount. He was in the Bush White House. The Democrats could easily just kind of sort of, it's like Festivus, if you will, George Costanza's Festivus, the airing of grievances. We can waste a lot of time in the Judiciary Committee just going over past injustices, real and feigned by the Democratic Party, or actually talk about what a justice does. And so that's what I'm looking for. Will it be a high road or a low road conversation?
Well, let me add one more episode to the Forrest Gump story. Mm-hmm. David Brock, the head of Media Matters, who spent the last more than a decade, I guess almost two decades, slandering conservatives, really smearing them in public. In his memoir, Blinded by the Right, where he turned his back on the conservatives, he'd originally been a conservative journalist.
Right.
Brett Kavanaugh makes cameos in that book.
Right.
Makes cameos in that book because
supposedly he called Hillary Clinton the B word. Right?
That's right. That's right. At a, I can't remember what the occasion was, but in the book, Brock says that about Kavanaugh. And who knows what sort of allegations people like David Brock are just going to start announcing. I am profoundly worried about I just gave the happy version of this, so I want to reiterate, I am actually profoundly worried about this. Mm. This nomination was going to be the most venomous nomination no matter when it happens, just because of who's being replaced, Kennedy, the swing vote.
Right.
You take that and you parachute it into the single most venomous political year of recent memory. And I think it all adds up to something that no one is really ready for. We think about the Justice Thomas hearings as like the high watermark and political bile at a Supreme Court nomination. That incident, that episode with the Anita Hill allegations was just a matter of weeks. What we're about to see is 2 months of cacophony surrounding this nomination. It's going to be a pressure cooker. And that's one of the reasons why I do wonder what's going to happen with Collins and Murkowski, because it's not just that they're going to make a decision tomorrow. It's that they're going to sit and endure this political pressure cooker for 2 months, right, along with the three Democratic senators everybody's watching, Manchin, Heitkamp, and Donnelly from Indiana.
Right.
And the pressure will continue and continue. And I don't think anybody is really prepared for what that's going to feel like by mid-September, and what the political ramifications of it will be.
It's a good time to own a small TV station in a small state like North Dakota or West Virginia or Montana, because there'll be a lot of political advertising coming your way in the next couple months.
Yeah, that's very, very true.
Adam White, I enjoyed the conversation.
Always. Thanks, Bill.
We'll have to do this again once the confirmation hearings begin.
Great.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. In this instance, 45's choice to be the Supreme Court's 114th Justice. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word, get your friends to have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for Hoover's Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Adam White and the rest of Hoover's fellowship to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. Adam White is on Twitter. His Twitter handle is @AdamJWhiteDC. That is @AdamJWhiteDC. And he's also in the podcast business. You didn't think you'd get away without mention of this. His new podcast is called Reasonable Disagreements. He and Richard Epstein, Hoover's own redoubtable Richard Epstein, will be discussing legal and policy issues and how they view things through their libertarian and conservative perspectives. Boy, that might even make the Judiciary Committee hearings look tame.
Well, it's Reasonable Disagreements. Richard is the reasonable one, and I disagree with him.
I look forward to listening to it, Adam. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. And as always, thanks for listening.
This podcast is a production of the Hoover Institution. For more podcasts and ideas from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org.